You probably won't see her before the wedding, I understand. But before the night is through, before you and she... He stopped. He didn't want to think about the end to that sentence. You should tell her. There it was again, the doomed look on Gifford's too handsome face. Have I a choice, sire? Do any of us have a choice where destiny is concerned? Gifford lowered his head. A man may fish with the worm that hath eat of a king, and eat of the fish that have fed of that worm, he said, his voice building in intensity. Edward stared at the young lord for a few long minutes. I assume that means you'll tell her. Yes, sire, the young lord mumbled and took his leave. Edward watched from the window as below in the courtyard Gifford mounted his horse and galloped off the palace grounds. Edward felt good about how the conversation had gone. Then he crossed to his bed and slung himself down into it. Pet came over to lick at his face. "Off with you, traitorous dog," he said, pushing her away playfully. But then he scooted over to make room, and she jumped up beside him. 5. Jane. The wedding day was upon her. The ceremony was being held at Durham House, the Dudleys' London home, which meant on Saturday afternoon Jane was taken across the city by carriage and deposited, along with her mother, the seamstress, and Adela, her lady-in-waiting, into the Dudleys' family library, which was to serve as a dressing chamber. Only it didn't seem as much of a library as it did an unused storage room, somewhat cleared in hasty preparation for the wedding. Light streamed through the windows, thrown open to let in the breeze. There were bookcases, Jane could almost feel them calling out to her, a stack of wooden trunks, and the gown, waiting on a wire frame.
"This is so exciting!"
chirped Adela as she fluttered around the sunlit room, touching everything as though it were all good luck. Puffs of dust flew up at her fingers.
"You're finally getting married!"
"Finally," Jane said, staring at the gown. It was gold and silver brocade, embroidered with diamonds and pearls. Recall that these were the days before Queen Victoria famously wore a white gown for her wedding and forever changed matrimonial fashion. It really was a lovely creation, and expensive, no doubt. Perhaps she'd even hear just how expensive if she were to protest this match even further. But Edward had asked her, and she would do this for him. A knot tightened in her stomach when she thought of Edward. Once, when she'd lived with Catherine Parr, when she and Edward had been hiding in the back of the library of Sudley Castle all afternoon, which they often did, and after she'd started complaining about her many terrible engagements, which she often did, Edward had poked her in the ribs and said, "Such high standards, Jane. Well, I suppose you could always marry me." Back then, marriage had seemed to her like a silly game, rather than a cage to be locked in, as it was starting to feel now.
"That'd be quite a risk you'd take, getting engaged to me," she'd replied. "You know I bring about the ruin of all of my potential suitors. Besides, I don't think I'd like to be queen. Too many rules."
"Oh, come now, it wouldn't be so bad." Edward had tapped her upturned nose and smiled. "We'd have a jolly time together." They'd both laughed like it was a joke, and never spoken of it further, but Jane had thought about it later, that he might have meant it. She'd suspected for a while that Thomas Seymour and her mother were plotting that very thing, sending her to live with the Dowager Queen to be educated and refined on the off chance that one day she'd marry Edward and become Queen herself. He was right, too. It wouldn't have been so bad, even if it was difficult to think of Edward as anything more than her friend. She'd read about romance, about how your heart was supposed to pound in the presence of your beloved, your breath was supposed to catch, etc., etc., and she'd never felt anything like that around Edward. But she could think of worse things than marrying her best friend. Far worse things. But then Catherine Parr had died in childbirth, and Thomas Seymour had committed treason and lost his head. Jane had been sent back to Bradgate, and her mother had started looking for eligible husbands again. And now Edward was dying, and Jane was getting married tonight. Probably, unless some kind of miracle happened. Afternoon transformed into evening, and it seemed less likely that a horrible catastrophe would befall the Dudley family and save Jane from her fate. The gown went on, the green velvet headdress went up, and Jane's hopes went down. The worst part? No books. Between all the hair plaiting and gown adjusting, Jane let her fingers drift across the book spines on the shelves of the library. History, philosophy, and science. Her favourite things. Things that would save her if the wedding got boring. No books! Lady Frances smacked Jane's hand away from the gilt-lettered spines. I will not have my daughter say her vows from behind a dusty old book! They'd be less dusty if the Dudley family took care of them. Jane gazed longingly at the literary cornucopia. Indeed dusty, but certainly still in fine enough shape to read 100 times. Maybe you'd prefer I brought my knitting? Watch your mouth! No one likes a sarcastic wife! A strand of Lady Frances's brown hair turned grey as if by magic. Not actual magic, mind you, but the magic that daughters possess over their mothers. As we all know, the only actual magic is Ethian magic. At least the wedding meant Jane no longer had to live with her mother. After a bit more tugging and twisting and distress over Jane's general flatness of bosom, there was a knock on the library door. It's time! A glance at the window revealed dusk had fallen. It was night. "What kind of man insists on getting married after dark?" she muttered as she was ushered from the room. "A boorish brute," Jane thought. "That's who." She shot one last longing look at the neglected books. Maybe, at least, they would come with the husband. They could make a trade. The books for... Well, she would figure out what he wanted, besides women. Edward had said he would speak to him. Even someone like Gifford couldn't say no to his king. Jane couldn't seem to catch her breath, and it wasn't just that her corset was too tight, although it was, extremely. She'd always known she'd have to get married, of course. The string of destitute ex-fiancés could not continue forever. But to someone who'd spent time with dozens, maybe hundreds of women, how could she compare? To Gifford, what would she be but another woman and the end to his debauchery? He'd resent her every day of their marriage, and not just because of her narrow, unsuitable for childbearing hips and her odd red hair. Jane tried to drag her feet on her way to the great room, but her mother hurried her along, and sooner than seemed possible they stood near the wide double doors, both thrown open to release the sound of music and voices. Flickering candlelight cast a haunting glow over Edward, who was waiting for her. He smiled and stood when she arrived, using the armrests for support as he did. "You look beautiful, Jane."
"You look..."
Jane didn't finish her thought. Today he was wearing the royal regalia, the crown and coat and gold dagger, all the fashion required of a king about to give away his cousin at the altar, but underneath the layers of brocade and fur he still looked thin, sick, dying.
"I know."
He plucked the end of his fur-lined coat between his white-gloved fingers.
I look as handsome and regal as ever, but don't stare, you'll embarrass me.
Jane mustered a smile. Now, Jane, Lady Frances said after all the appropriate greetings and genuflections to the king were made, try to be happy. This is your wedding day. Jane exchanged a look with Edward and rolled her eyes as her mother and lady-in-waiting went into the great room to take their places. Jane made sure to stay out of the line of sight from the guests. As soon as she appeared, people would expect her to begin the long trek to her betrothed.
"Jane," Edward said when they were alone, "I wouldn't ask this of you unless it was important."
"I know."
She didn't need a repeat of yesterday's conversation.
"I did speak to him," Edward said. "His nights of carousing are over."
"The nights of carousing that have already occurred can never be undone."
She tried to cross her arms, but the embroidered gems caught, so she left her hands at her sides. If she ruined the gown before she'd even said her vows, her mother would never let her forget it.
"He's a dissolute man, a reprobate, a..."
She'd run out of synonyms. That was disappointing.
"Janey!"
Edward coughed into a handkerchief that was already speckled with pink. She waited a moment, unsure whether to help or say something about his condition, but as he stuffed the handkerchief back into a pocket, his face was red with the exertion or embarrassment or both. Instead, she jumped on to the next subject that would help take both of their minds off his affliction.
"So you saw Gifford. Prepare me. How bad is the nose?"
A general flurry of motion came from the great room, and Jane realized that she'd moved within view of the wedding guests. Edward's eyebrows raised.
"I guess you're about to find out."
With a sigh, Jane picked up her bouquet, white roses of York and cowslips, and took her place by the king's side. Arm in arm, they entered the great room. It was filled with people, all of them staring at her. What she wouldn't give for a book to hide behind. She'd have brought a spare book for Edward, too, though perhaps he was more used to the attention, what with being king. Hundreds of candles lit the great room, a line of them illuminating a path to the altar, where a priest and the groom waited. There were even more candles behind them, which made it impossible to really get a good look at her betrothed. Together, Jane and Edward made a slow, stately march down the aisle, ignoring the murmurs about how the king seemed sickly, and how the colour of her gown made her hair look court jester red, and how odd and hasty this wedding was. Jane tried to shrink into the gown. Then, much too soon, they'd reached the altar, and Edward took one of Jane's hands.
"To you, Lord Gifford Dudley, I give my cousin and dearest friend, Lady Jane Grey." Before Jane's hand was passed from one man to the other, she gave Edward a light squeeze and blinked away the tears prickling at the backs of her eyes.
This couldn't be happening. Not really.
"Thank you."
Gifford's voice was deep, but his tone completely bland as he took Jane's hand and helped her up the step where she stood before him at last. She looked up and up and nearly crushed her wedding bouquet. Gifford Dudley was unfairly handsome. Impressively tall and well-shaped around the neck and shoulders, with glossy chestnut hair tied into a short ponytail and expressive brown eyes. And his nose! His nose! It was perfectly shaped, not too long or short, not too plump or skinny, and even the pores were discreet. There was no trace of the Dudley nose curse.
Praise all the gods and saints. Lord Gifford Dudley may have had an unfortunate name, but he did not have the nose. She wanted to sing. She wanted to spin around to where Edward was, taking a seat in the front, and tell him all about Gifford's perfect nose. It was a miracle, a marvel, a wonder, a relief. After all, she would be expected to kiss this man by the end of the ceremony, and the last thing she needed was to lose an eye. Then again, she might have expected he'd be free of the curse, or there would be a lot of one-eyed women in England. The elation drained out of her. Well, so he was handsome. Good for him. It wasn't as though there weren't other handsome men in the world, men who didn't spend every night with a new woman. His perfect nose did not excuse his poor behaviour. For his part, Gifford did not seem to find her appearance remarkable. Of course not. Few did, unless they were commenting on the hair. The wedding continued, and Jane dared a glance at the guests. Edward sat stiffly in his chair, his mouth drawn tight like he was in some kind of pain. Her mother sat with the groom's family. Jane recognised Lord Dudley and his wife, who leaned away from each other, which did not bode well for the marriage Gifford must have grown up observing. Lady Dudley sat close to a young girl, who clutched a doll in one arm and gave a shy wave. Then there was Stan and his wife, both with stiff postures and haughty faces, and a young child between them, toddling on the pew. If Stan remembered his crass assumptions about Jane the other day, he gave no indication, but Jane allowed her eyes to narrow at him slightly as the priest began declaring the all-wonders of holy matrimony. First, true love. No danger of that here. Gifford was staring over her shoulder, a bored, put-upon look on his face. Still bitter about what he and Edward had talked about, undoubtedly. Second, virtue. Jane snorted, drawing looks, from her mother especially, who developed another grey hair. Third, progeny. Jane blanched and went cold. She'd almost managed to forget about that part of marriage. Children, the making of. She would be expected to produce a child. Children, plural. After all, Jane had no brother, which meant it would be her job to conceive heirs for the Grey estate. The fact that women often died having babies, or shortly thereafter, she was thinking of Edward's mother, who'd lived only a few days before departing this world, was alarming enough, while having multiple children was just tempting fate multiple times, especially considering her deficiency in the childbearing hips department. But even that was a worry for another time, because as the priest droned on about the joy of children, how every child would strengthen the bond between the parents, Jane realized that tonight there would be... That was she... They... would have to... Gifford looked rather stricken, too, as though the idea of the two of them creating offspring had not yet occurred to him, either. Jane clenched her jaw. So she had red hair, and he preferred brunettes? Was she that unattractive that even someone as questionably virtuous as Gifford the Carouser would not want to... She couldn't even think it. Not now. What had her mother called it? The very special hug. When she'd been engaged to Humphrey Hangrot, her mother had tried to prepare her for the wedding night. The very special hug might be unpleasant, Lady Frances had said, but it's part of the wedding night and part of your duty as a wife. You'll need to produce as many heirs as you can manage. The event itself will be over quickly, at least. Don't think too much about it. Jane had just stared at her mother, mortified, and later tracked down every book on anatomy that had ever been written.
There were the obvious differences between a man's body and a woman's body, ones anyone could notice, and then she'd discovered the not-so-evident differences. It hadn't taken long to figure out what went where, and what a terrifying thing the very special hug must be for a woman. And now, as the priest announced it was time for the vows, Jane's stomach knotted and the bouquet slipped in her sweaty hands. Gifford's tone was paper dry as he said his part. "I, Gifford Dudley, hereby declare my devotion to you. I swear to love you, protect you, be faithful to you, and make you the happiest woman in the world. My love for you is as deep as the ocean and as bright as the sun. I will protect you from every danger. I am blind to every woman but you. Your happiness is paramount in my heart." From the first row of guests, Gifford's mother dabbed at her eyes with a handkerchief, and the girl fought a small fit of giggles. Edward was stoic-faced, his blood-dotted handkerchief crumpled in his fingers. Gifford took her damp hand and pushed a ring onto her finger. "I give myself to you."
"I receive you."
It sounded more like a croak.
"And I, Jane Grey, hereby declare my devotion to you. I swear to love you, parley with you, be faithful to you, and make you the happiest man in the world."
The original version of the vow her mother had suggested had said, "obey you," but that simply would not do. It was enough that Jane had agreed to keep the word love where she had tried to insert the phrase, "feel some sort of emotion," but with "obey" she could not bend. She would consult him regarding decisions. She didn't have to listen to him after that. And she would be faithful. She might try to make him happy, unless he insisted on being unreasonable. She continued, "My love for you makes the wind appear a mere breath and the sea a mere drop. I will consult your wisdom. I am deaf to the call of temptation. Your happiness is my northern star." She took his hand and shoved on the ring awkwardly, her bouquet still clutched in her fingers. "I give myself to you." Never had she dreamed of uttering such words.
"I receive you."
He, at least, looked equally miserable. The priest beamed.
"Is there anyone who would like to contest this match?"
"Please, please, please."
Jane risked a glance at Edward, who had not moved at all. There would be no last-minute rescue, no awful coincidence, nothing to keep this from going any further.
"Then," declared the priest, "I name you husband and wife. You may kiss."
Jane squeezed her eyes shut and waited. Entire seconds fell by, and then a touch warmed her chin and lifted her face, which she'd turned down to her shoes. The kiss came quickly. It wasn't anything more than a touch of his lips to hers, so light it might not have happened at all. But the guests were cheering, and when she and Gifford turned to face everyone, Edward's eyes were shining, her mother wore a triumphant smile, and the girl with Gifford's parents was kissing her doll.
"Now to survive the feast."
Gifford's words were low, perhaps not even for her, but they were the first real words he'd spoken since they'd met.
"Perhaps there will be a buxom serving girl to help you pass the time," she snapped without thinking.
Gifford met her eyes coldly. "Perhaps there will be a book for you to hide your face in." They moved down the aisle together to lead the way to the wedding feast, and the last shred of hope in her shriveled and died. He was as awful as she'd expected, and now she would be spending the rest of her life with him. And suddenly, the rest of her life stretched out before her with the marriage bed and children and seeing each other only when was absolutely necessary, seemed like an exceedingly long time. 6. Gifford. Maybe he had been a bit rude. But to be fair, he'd had his reasons. One reason, which was, he hadn't been prepared for the fairness of the maiden who had met him at the altar. Until the ceremony, he had in jest been vocal about the possibility that Jane was hiding behind books because she was trying to conceal the hideousness of her face, but deep down he'd hoped it was true, because that would have made it easier to tell her the truth about his horse curse. If she had been less attractive, there might have been the chance that a half-horse, half-man was the best she could do. But Jane Grey could certainly do better than Gifford. Not that she was a stunning creature. She did have that fire-red hair, after all, but G had to admit that not one in 20 men would find her unseemly. Her eyes were the colour of varnished oak flecked with deep mahogany, perceptive eyes that seemed to drink in everything around her. Her skin was creamy and unblemished. Her figure had all the expected parts in all the right configurements. But it was the supple pout of her lips, and they had pouted a lot during the ceremony, that could inspire poetry. Like kissing cherries, he thought, but that wasn't a very good comparison. And now he had to tell those lips about the curse. He'd promised the king he would share the news with his bride before he and she... before they... what was the official term for it? Ugh. Consummated, G thought. What was it with this obsession with consummation of a marriage? As if the I do's weren't enough. At least the nobility of England no longer required live witnesses to the event. But right now, at the wedding supper, a bigger problem was emerging. Every time G thought about how to break the news to her, he gulped down a cup of ale, and he thought about it a lot, every time he looked at his new bride. And he looked at her a lot. As a side note, he decided her frown would not inspire poetry, because the poem would read, "Her frown made him desire they be better strangers." And what was Jane's relationship with the king, anyway? When Edward had summoned G expressly to tell him how special Jane was, Gifford had gotten the distinct impression that perhaps the king would have preferred to have Jane for himself. Yes, she was Edward's cousin, but perhaps they were kissing cousins, judging from the way Jane had clutched the king's arm as they'd walked down the aisle together, and the way she'd kept glancing in Edward's direction during the ceremony. Perhaps his wife was in love with another man. The thought left a bad taste in his mouth. He washed it down with more ale. He turned away and scanned the crowd. Billingsley was coming toward him, threading his way through the tables. "My lord," he whispered in G's ear, "your father has asked me to gently urge you to switch from ale to cider." "Billingsley?" G said, marvelling how long one could sustain the S in Billingsley's name. Perhaps he had consumed more ale than he'd thought. "Billingsley?" He leaned away from his bride.
"I wonder if you might do me a favour."
"Yes, my lord."
I wonder if you might tell Lady Jane about the whole... G waved his hand in a circle as if to say, fill in the blank about the horse stuff. Billingsley looked from Jane back to G.
My lord, under other circumstances I would gladly assist you, but I believe the lady would prefer to hear such news from you.
Coward! G took another swig from the goblet of ale in front of him. Where was the honour among servants these days? He caught a hard glance from his new wife, and judging from the narrowness of her eyes, he assumed she disapproved of his ale consumption. He wished his ale consumption was all there was to cause disapproval. G raised his glass toward her and said loudly,
"To my beautiful bride!"
The entire assembly hall raised their goblets in response.
"To the Lady Jane,"
they said in unison. G took another gulp and thought about the best way to break the equestrian news.
"My dear, you know those four-legged majestical beasts of the land? Well, you married one."
No, that could not be the right approach.
"My sweet, have you ever had a difficult time deciding between man or beast? Well, now you don't have to."
Again he thought better of this tactic.
"Sweet lady, there are those of us who sleep lying down, and those of us who sleep standing up. I can do both."
"No."
"You know how some men claim to have another... perhaps hairier side? Have you ever cursed the fact that your loved one has just the two legs? Did you know that horses have incredible balance? Hey, what's that over there?"
And then he would gallop away. G shook his head and could almost feel the ale swirling in his brain. It was at that moment he reasoned to himself that the assembly hall was not the place to tell his wife about his alter ego. Too many people. Hours later, when G was practically sloshing with ale, he came to the conclusion that the walk to their bedchamber was not the place to tell his wife either. Too many mounted deer heads on the walls. Minutes later, as his wife stomped into the bedchamber, and G then mimed the action of a man carrying a woman across the threshold, he decided that the bedchamber was not the appropriate place to disclose his secret. Too quiet. After that, the only other possible time to tell her would have been the few seconds between the act of stripping off his boots and then falling downward, and he happily would have told her then, only his lips were smashed against the wooden slats of the floor before he could get the words out. But he promised the king he would tell Jane, and a promise was a promise. So just before the world went dark, he said, against the floor,
"My lady, I am a horse."
"Pardon me?" Jane's voice came from somewhere in the black clouds behind his lids. He could not repeat himself. Besides, it wasn't his fault his wife couldn't understand plain English. G wasn't sure what awakened him. Perhaps the distant sound of servants beginning breakfast preparations in the kitchen. They always started so early. Or maybe it was the sound of soft breathing coming from the bed above him. G was not used to sharing a bedchamber with another person, although at the moment, because of his hazy brain, he couldn't remember exactly who it was. Or perhaps it was the grey tones of the impending dawn. Dawn! Dawn! G threw off the blanket covering him. His new wife must have draped it over him at some point during the night. And using the fringe hanging down the side of the headboard tapestry, he pulled himself up. Jane was asleep, her red hair splayed out over the pillow like a halo of fire. G paused for a moment, admiring the soft swell of her cheekbones, and wondered why he had not previously noticed that her neck curved in a very delicate and appropriate way as it connected to her shoulder. He would have to include that particular body part in his poem about her pout. Dawn, he reminded himself. It was moments away. G reached out and jostled her shoulder. The change was so close he could feel it. Jane moaned and shook off his hand. "My lady, wake up!" She didn't respond. "Jane!" he shouted louder, nudging her. She turned toward his voice and her eyes fluttered.
"It is not morning,"
she said. "Yes, it is. What do you think that light through yonder window is? I must warn you of something, and it really is not extraordinarily consequential, but it can be rather alarming if you're not prepared for it." Why was he using so many words? Why hadn't he practiced this speech? He'd barely ever said two words to her in a row, and now suddenly he was using all the words. "You've heard of that ancient, some would say beautiful, magic of our ancestors." Uh-oh. It was too late. In one swoop, he was standing over her, much taller than he'd been a moment ago.
Jane's eyes went wide. She scooted to the farthest edge of the bed and brought her fingers to her lips. "What?"
G stepped backward, his hindquarters smashing up against the wall. This bedchamber was certainly not made with a horse on his wedding night in mind. Originally, he had planned on sharing his equestrian news, gently excusing himself just before dawn, and trotting down to the stables. Of course, that plan would have required significantly less ale. Jane furrowed her brows.
"Gifford?"
"It's G," he thought, but then he remembered he hadn't had the time or the mental acuity to tell her to call him G. He threw his head back and let it drop again in what he hoped would look like a nod.
She raised a gentle hand toward his face.
G leaned down and sniffed her palm, and then the curves of her fingers, his equestrian instincts taking over. He caught a whiff of wine on her wrist, surely left over from the night before, and used his horse lips to try to draw out the remnants.
"Oh, no," he thought. "I just nibbled on her wrist."
He couldn't help it, though. The wine had been particularly aromatic last night. He would have to ask the servants which year was used, but before he did anything else, he had to force himself to stop nibbling her wrist. He needed a distraction from the smell of wine, so he lowered his head to the table next to the bed and promptly ate the bridal bouquet. There, that would satisfy his nibbling for the time being. When he was finished, Jane sighed and gathered up the torn stems of what was once a bundle of white roses of York and a dozen cowslips. She remembered because his mother had picked them out specifically, having pledged her troth holding a similar bouquet when she'd married G's father.
"You are an Ethian?"
Something between awe and yearning appeared on Jane's face. G gave his best nod. Jane set the stems down on the table and turned back to G.
"You must tell me everything. How did you get the magic? When did it first appear?"
G tried to follow her questions, but a sensuous odour wafted into the bedchamber, filling his large nostrils and making his mouth water. He sniffed loudly and whinnied.
"Gifford, are you listening to me?"
Jane's voice cut through his preoccupation with his olfactory senses. He wanted to answer that, of course, he wasn't listening to her. She obviously wasn't the source of the scent. He stamped his right hoof on the wooden floor, hoping the lady would understand the simplest of horse signals.
"Change back so you can speak to me," Jane said. "Please."
But to G, it sounded like, "Mwah, mwah, mwah." and mwah-mwah-mwah-mwah, for all he could focus on was the smell in the air.
Apples, she thought. He closed his eyes and shook his mane, with a helping of hay.
The door to the bedchamber squeaked open an inch, and the aroma intensified. G turned away from the lady, who was apparently still talking because her mouth was moving, and toward the door.
Lady Jane?
It was Billingsley's voice coming through. Jane pulled the bedcovers up to her neck.
Yes?
It's Billingsley, my lady. I believe Lord G is still within the room. I am here to help.
Please come in, Jane said. Billingsley entered, carrying an apple in one hand and clutching stalks of hay in the other. G released a full-blown neigh at the sight. Billingsley held out the apple, and G latched onto it with his teeth, the succulent juices dripping onto his tongue.
There's a good boy,
Billingsley said, scratching G's neck.
Before he could consider how it would look to Jane, G nuzzled Billingsley's cheek in response. He quickly pulled back and shook out his mane in what he hoped was a very dignified manner.
Yes, he was a horse, but he was still a man, except anatomically. And he would be treated accordingly with the utmost respect.
Here, boy,
Billingsley said, dangling the hay in front of G's nose and then tossing the bundle into the far corner of the room.
Fetch.
G sauntered over to the corner and began chewing.
I asked him to change back to talk to me, but he won't, Jane said. It's disrespectful to remain a horse in the bedchamber, I should think.
Considering what had to have been a monumental shock, she seemed to be taking the equestrian news rather well.
My lady, Lord G does not have the ability to change as he pleases. He is a horse from sun up to sun down.
Does not have the ability? I've read about Ethians who undergo their initial change in moments of great emotion, but the ability to control it can be learned through focused training. All it requires is determination and discipline. Perhaps Gifford simply lacks that, but I would be pleased to help. I've quite a knowledge of Ethians.
And good feelings gone. He blew a raspberry toward her, and she flinched.
I'm sorry. Did I offend the beast? Jane said.
My lady, you might consider leaving the bedchamber to Lord G for the day.
Her lips pressed together.
Why should I be the one to leave?
Because Lord G, in his present state, cannot fit through the door.
This was true, for the average size of a human being during this age was much shorter than it is today, and the door frames reflected that. At this, G looked frantically about for escape options. The window was nearly large enough for him to leap through. However, they were at least 50 feet above the ground, and horses were not known for their ability to absorb the impact of a 50-foot free fall. G scraped his hoof along the floorboards as if he were a bull looking to charge. The only problem was, he had nowhere to go. He snorted. With no place to run, the curse was feeling very much like a prison, as opposed to its usual feeling of freedom.
My lady, Lord G has an affinity for running when he is in this condition, and now that he is trapped here for the day, and he has eaten...
Jane held her hand up.
Say no more, Billingsley.
She turned toward the horse.
Lord Gifford! It seems fitting that you be relegated to your room all day, considering your behaviour last night. Perhaps the confinement will provide the impetus you need to develop the ability to control your gift.
Gift? G's nostrils flared. There's no controlling it, he thought, and call me G.
He spent the day pacing. He knew this situation was only temporary and that he would not be trapped in this room forever, but for G, running across the countryside, tethered to nothing, was an essential part of his soul. He often wondered if that was how he got the curse in the first place.
Something deep inside of him yearned to run, to break free of the disappointment his parents displayed toward him. Not only was he the second, and therefore unimportant, son, the one without the esteemed nose, but as he grew up, he was always wasting his time reading poetry and plays. Rubbish, his father had called it. As a boy of 13, he'd skipped out on his fencing classes to read under a tree behind Durham House. When his father caught him and threatened severe punishment, G had run across the field, down the road, leading away from London, and didn't stop until he reached the edge of the dark forest. G lived to run, and ran to live. And now, after the humiliation of turning into a horse in front of his new bride, he was trapped in this room like a caged beast, was the word she'd used. A wife was simply a new person to disappoint. And since this was supposedly the first day of his happily ever after, he could only conclude that marriage consisted of 4 solid walls, a door too small to squeeze through, and a window too high to jump from. The lines of a poem formed in his head. The stifling air, damp and dank for want of release. The horse, too still and stuck, in need of a little grease, to shimmy his frame through a door too small. But even then, he'd be stuck in the hall. Not his best work. 7. Edward.
Edward, dear, Mistress Penn said from her chair beside his bed, eat your soup.
She lifted the spoon to his lips, and he allowed her to feed him a few swallows, but then he turned his face away.
Just 2 more bites, she coaxed.
I'm not hungry.
He would have liked to remind her that he was the king and not some little boy she could boss around, but getting all those words out seemed like a lot of effort. Instead, he fell back against the pillows and pressed closer into the steady warmth of Pet's body where she was stretched out beside him. The dog's tail thumped against the blankets. She licked her lips and gave him a yearning look, expressing that if he didn't want to eat his food, she'd gladly undertake such a task for him. He was too tired to give her any.
Sire, the nurse tried again, you must eat if you are to regain your strength.
He knew this was true, but it didn't make it any less humiliating. He was mortified when he thought about last night. How, as he'd walked to the carriage after the wedding feast, his legs had abruptly given out underneath him, and he'd tumbled to the muddy ground. How one of his stewards had lifted him easily in his arms, like the king had no more substance than a woman, and carried him the rest of the way. How he'd also had to be carried up the stairs to his bedchamber, and how he'd spent every moment since then in bed. He'd slept for the entire night and most of the morning, but had awakened to a feeling of bone-deep exhaustion, as if he had not slept a wink, and now he was being spoon-fed like a toddler. He was dying, he finally admitted to himself. He'd known this before, of course, but now the idea seemed real. His strength had abandoned him, and he doubted it would ever return. The coughing fits were coming more frequently, and there was a lingering pain in his joints and spine. Even his head felt diluted, as if his thoughts had to work their way through a bank of clouds to reach him. He was dying. Already? Hadn't it been less than a week ago that Master Boo Boo had given him 6 months to live? A year at best? He was dying, he thought numbly. Sooner than expected, apparently. Soup was of no consequence.
Sire, the nurse prodded.
Leave me, he muttered.
And when she did not move away quickly enough, he barked,
leave me!
And Pet raised her head and bared her teeth at the old woman. Mistress Penn bustled away.
Edward soothed Pet by resting his hand on the smooth space at the crown of her head and stroking. Her tail thumped again. He closed his eyes. Behind his eyelids, he replayed Jane's wedding. He remembered her standing in her wedding gown, all gold and silver and jewels, her red hair shining. He recalled the way Gifford's gaze had swept over Jane as they had approached him, the flicker of surprise and definite male interest in his eyes before he'd forced his expression back into perfect blankness. When Edward had seen that flicker, he'd felt hope for Jane, that maybe this would be more than a marriage of convenience, that maybe she'd find love. He thought, "I will never find love." He remembered the touch of Jane's small, cool hand in the crook of his arm as he'd walked with her. He thought, "I will never feel a woman's touch." He remembered the way Jane's cheeks had flushed when Gifford had tilted her face up to be kissed. He sighed. Pet scooched up on the bed and licked his chin. He pushed her head away, but resumed stroking her behind the ear. His last moment with Jane had been at the end of the night, when Lord Dudley had announced that it was time for the young couple to turn in, as he'd phrased it, and Jane had come to him to say goodbye. He'd known by the gleam in her dark eyes and the ramrod straight way that she was holding herself that she was both furious and terrified at what came next. The consummation. "Jane," he'd leaned to whisper in her ear, "don't fret. You'll be all right."
"He's drunk," she'd hissed, "so now we can add inebriant to the list of his charms. A boozer, a lush, a tippler, a souse."
"You will find something to like about him," he'd answered and kissed her cheek. "Be happy, cousin, for me." Then Gifford had led her away to their bedchamber. Edward thought, "I am never going to consummate anything. I'm going to die a virgin." And he'd felt more sorry for himself than ever. The floor beside his bed creaked, and he opened his eyes. Master Boo Boo was hovering over him, and behind him Edward could make out the outline of Lord Dudley's nose. The doctor took Edward's hand and felt for a pulse at his wrist, then frowned. "So it's good news, is it?" Edward smiled at his own joke and was immediately overtaken by coughing.
"I'm afraid not, sir, Your Majesty," said Boo Boo when the coughs subsided. "You appear to have taken a turn for the worst. Your heart is very weak. Perhaps the wedding was simply too much exertion."
Edward resolved that he would never, ever, no matter how bad things got, regret being there for Jane at her wedding.
"So what's to be done about it?" "I've brought a tonic."
Boo Boo helped Edward to sit up as Lord Dudley handed him a goblet of a dark liquid that tasted as bad as it smelled, like rotted leaves with a touch of fennel. But almost immediately after the tonic touched his tongue, he felt slightly better, clearer of mind, less exhausted.
"I should probably bleed you at some point,"
Boo Boo continued delicately after Edward had dutifully downed the tonic. Edward tried not to cringe. He'd been bled once before when he'd first become ill. He thought that if anything, the bleeding had only made him feel weaker. Plus, it was unsettling watching his blood drain into a bowl.
"No," he said, "no bleeding."
Boo Boo didn't argue, but the doctor didn't seem to be afraid of him any longer, which Edward found disappointing. Lord Dudley shuffled forward, hefting a writing tray, which he placed carefully across Edward's lap. Then he produced a large parchment scroll and unrolled it on the tray. "Revised decree on the line of succession," the scroll read, followed by a lot of very fine print that swam before Edward's eyes. "What is this?" Edward asked.
"Your royal will, Your Highness,"
the Duke said, motioning for Boo Boo to bring him a quill and a pot of ink.
"We discussed how you would name Jane Grey's male heir as your successor, remember?"
Edward had a vague recollection of this,
"but considering this most recent turn in your health,"
Dudley continued,
"I thought it might be prudent to revise the line of succession."
For a moment, Edward was confused. Then he realized,
"Because you don't think I'll live long enough for Jane to have a son."
Dudley said nothing, but his gaze lingered on the parchment. Edward squinted to read the flowery calligraphy. At the top was his title, Edward the Sixth, by the grace of God, King of England, Ireland, and France. Back then, the English monarchy liked to claim ownership of France, even though France had a perfectly suitable king of its own. The relationship between the two countries was obviously strained as a result.
"For lack of issue of my body,"
he read, then stopped to take a breath,
"upon the event of my death, I bequeath my kingdom and the entitlements and protections thereof to the Lady Jane Grey and the male heirs who follow her."
He glanced up at Dudley.
"You want me to make Jane herself the queen?"
Dudley nodded sagely, his eyes gleaming above his great nose. Edward didn't know why he felt surprised at this news.
"But she's a woman," he murmured. "The crown can't go to a woman, right?"
"Jane would have my son to guide her," Dudley said. "And me."
Well, that made sense, thought Edward. Lord Dudley had been one of his most faithful and trusted advisers over the years. The Duke had never led him astray. Dudley handed him the quill. Edward hesitated. He ignored Dudley's protests and rose shakily from his bed, crossed to the window to stare down at the courtyard. For just a moment, he thought he actually saw Jane down below him, the jewels of her golden gown catching the sun, her hair a gleam of red. But when he looked again, she was gone. Jane was on her honeymoon, he told himself, not here. Then he allowed himself to truly consider the idea of Jane as queen. His little, stubborn and bookish, utterly sweet cousin Jane, Queen of England. She wasn't going to like that. She'd even said as much once. Too many rules. But what was his alternative? Mary was still a verity and a royal stick in the mud. Bess was still of an uncertain opinion when it came to her stance on Ethians. Jane was the only decent choice left from the royal line, unless you factored in Mary, Queen of Scots. He shuddered.
"Queen Jane,"
he whispered to himself.
"Queen Jane."
It had a nice ring to it, he thought. Jane would be a kind queen, for one thing. She was well-educated. Some would even say too well-educated for a woman. She was clever. She had backbone, wouldn't let the councillors make all the decisions. She could make a good ruler, an excellent ruler even, in spite of the whole female problem. He allowed himself the sentimentality of picturing Jane in the palace, living in his chambers and taking her meals at his table and reading the books from his library, wearing his crown.
"Is there a problem, sire?" Dudley prompted. "Do you need to lie down?"
"Give me the document," Edward said. Dudley moved the parchment to a nearby side table, and Edward signed his name carefully.
The Duke leaned over him to drip wax onto the bottom of the paper and helped Edward to press the ring with the royal seal into the wax. After that was finished, Dudley signed the paper himself as a witness, along with Master Boo Boo. Then Dudley rolled the scroll up and whisked it out of sight. Weariness tugged at Edward again, and he got back into bed, sinking against his plethora of pillows. He closed his eyes. He had just made Jane the most powerful woman in England. He liked the idea, but there was still something nagging at him, a doubt, a whisper of worry. He tried to ignore it. His stomach rumbled, and he decided that any misgivings he might be feeling were due to how hollow and exhausted